Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The economics of Martin Luther King Day, the uninsured who aren't signing up for Obamacare, and what if big data could find you a job? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From APM in New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is your Marketplace podcast for Monday, January 20th, Martin Luther King Day. Good to have you with us. U.S. markets are closed for the holiday. So are federal government offices and many at the state and local level, along with schools. The federal holiday honoring Dr. King was established in 1986. It was adopted by many states gradually after that, though in some cases not without controversy. Many Americans make it a day of community service and volunteering. But from the standpoint of a lot of consumers and companies, it can seem like another day of doing business. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Walking around Portland, Oregon, I couldn't find many businesses closed for the holiday.
Yes, we would, of course, would like more businesses and more people to recognize and commemorate the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King.
That's Diedrich Muhammad, Director of Economic Programs at the NAACP. He's reacting to a survey by Bloomberg that found about one-third of U.S. employers give MLK Day off as a paid holiday. That number's been creeping up slowly in the past decade and is now about on par with President's Day. But Muhammad says it's not all about a day off.
I think it is fair to ask, does it always require that people just shut down their businesses? Or are there activities at businesses that could actually help highlight the memory, the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King?
And in fact, roughly 1 in 10 employers do support educational programs and community service projects to mark the day. Sarah Willie LeBreton, a sociologist at Swarthmore College, says that's a good start. And she says just closing up shop isn't always possible.
Small businesses are in a more challenged situation because they often have a smaller profit margin. But there are ways in which you can designate a portion of your profits to go to organizations that are advancing social equality.
William Spriggs at Howard University serves as chief economist for the ACLU. He thinks the emphasis on service may distract attention from Dr. King's focus before his assassination on poverty and economic justice.
A lot of people feel compelled to do an act of service. He was calling for something far more revolutionary than painting schools or cleaning parks. He wanted to fight for things like raising the minimum wage, a guaranteed income.
Spriggs says Dr. King was controversial in life, and it's good there's a holiday now to keep his controversial ideas front and center. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
As we said earlier, the financial markets here are closed today. Traders are home and high-speed trading supercomputers are presumably humming a little more quietly. But when the U.S. markets are closed, what does that mean for the ones in the rest of the world and vice versa? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has our story.
When one of the world's major stock markets is closed, it's kind of like one of those days when half the office is out.
Often holiday markets are less vibrant than days when major market centers are not closed.
That's Andy Brooks, a vice president at T. Rowe Price. Markets aren't just less vibrant, they're measurably less volatile. The reason is that trading isn't just buying and selling shares, it's about information. Craig Pirong teaches finance at the University of Houston.
The trading process itself generates information about the value of stocks.
People buy and sell based on all kinds of info, public or private, local or global, and they learn a lot by watching how other people trade. When that's not happening in one place, it can affect trading in other places.
And so to the extent that there's less information being, you know, sort of generated by the trading process in the U.S., that means that there's less information in these other markets.
Of course, the next day, when a market opens, everyone has to catch up on what news there was. John Elder teaches finance at Colorado State.
When the market's open, they have to incorporate all that information into stock prices very quickly.
So the day after a holiday, prices tend to be more volatile. Elder says you can see this even on Mondays after a weekend. Heather Brilliant is head of equity and corporate research for Morningstar. She says once in a while, weird things can happen when one market's closed.
Let's say a company reported earnings today in Europe and investors didn't like the earnings and many people wanted to get out.
But Americans might feel totally differently. There might be enough of them to buy that stock or moderate a negative trend. But the U.S. market's closed.
Therefore, the price could go down more than it would otherwise.
So all in all, when one market is out of the game, the others are duller and sometimes a little bit weirder. Again, T. Rowe Price's Andy Brooks.
Investors ought to be wary to take any market moves that are made during holiday markets as having an incredible significance.
Because pretty soon, things usually get back to normal. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
And we'll give you all those overseas details when we do the numbers. There are some striking new numbers out today about the Affordable Care Act and the number of people enrolling for coverage who were previously uninsured. A report from McKinsey & Company, quoted in the Wall Street Journal, says that only 11% of the people who signed up for coverage on the healthcare exchanges didn't have insurance before. Those data don't reflect all the people signing up, just a statistical sample. But to talk about it, we've got our healthcare reporter Dan Gorenstein from the Health Desk at WHYY. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Lizzie.
11% is not a big number. Insurance companies were supportive of the law in part because they saw a chance to increase their customer base. They may not be that psyched about what looks like a pretty small number preliminarily. What's the reaction here?
That's a solid point, Lizzie. You know, insurers certainly, and what we're going to see over the coming months is that insurers are going to be really ramping up their advertising spending. So if you turn on the TV, be aware before March 31st, which is the new deadline for anybody who wants to get insurance through the exchanges, they're probably going to be inundated by a lot of commercials with the insurance companies saying, hey, come sign up with us. For a little perspective here, Cece Connolly with PricewaterhouseCoopers said, you really have to understand that for insurance companies, this exchange marketplace really is just a tiny fraction of their business.
They are really viewing 2014 as the learning year. It's almost as if we've got our bicycle and our training wheels right now, because so much of this is brand new territory.
A larger question is, does it matter who the people are who are buying coverage on the exchange? Does it matter if they were uninsured previously or if they bought their own insurance or had insurance through a job?
From the insurer's point of view, Lizzie, this is really a mixed bag. On the one hand, if there are lots of people who are uninsured showing up, you know, we don't know much about, the insurer isn't going to know much about their medical past. And there's a lot of worry and consternation that these are people who haven't seen doctors in years and they're going to need all kinds of tests and procedures and ultimately, you know, really expensive care, expensive front-end care. However, if you end up with not as many uninsured people buying plans on the exchanges, then these are people who've probably already had primary care doctors. Their conditions are most likely more in check than not. And so potentially it could be a bit of a good thing, a silver lining, even though the insurers aren't getting as much new business as they'd like from the uninsured.
For folks who didn't buy plans, why didn't they?
You know, I think there are a lot of reasons. Like, obviously, part of it, healthcare.gov, the federal exchange website, was a disaster in the first months. And lots of people couldn't get on, and people are still continuing to struggle to log on and make phone calls and get in. So I think there are technical issues that are certainly part of the problem. Beyond that, though, you've got to look at price, Lizzie. I mean, you know, a lot of people who I talk to insist there are good deals out there to be had. But you've got to think about this. I mean, I did see one analysis that suggested that if you're a young, healthy person and you go without insurance, you're probably going to end up paying under $500. If you get insurance and you factor in the out-of-pocket costs and the premium up front, you're probably looking at over $1,200. So young, healthy people might balk at that.
two important points here, Dan. These do not include the Medicaid expansion, and these are early numbers, right?
That's right. This is a preliminary report, and it should be said, Lizzie, that this is not the federal government coming out with numbers. So that's just a contextual point. And then you're right. You know, you might be a low-income earner, and you'll get coverage through a Medicaid program rather than through the exchange marketplace, as it were. So that's another option for people. However, if you don't qualify for Medicaid, if you earn too much money for that program, then the exchange is sort of your only option if you want to have health care coverage.
Dan Gorenstein, who covers healthcare for us, thank you so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Here in the U.S., we, of course, take our weekends on Saturday and Sunday. But that doesn't happen everywhere. As of January 1st, weekends now officially start on Friday in parts of Malaysia, so the Muslim majority can attend prayers. Johor, one of the Malaysian states trying the switch, has been benefiting from a construction boom, and its residents aren't entirely sold on the change. The BBC's Jennifer Pack has this report.
In Malaysia, Muslims get office breaks to pray, but for some it's still a struggle to get to the mosque on time, especially on Fridays, when all Muslim men must be there. They battle traffic, then wash their face, hands, and feet before prayer. It's tiring, and the Sultan of Johor says some men end up sleeping instead of listening to the sermon. That's why he wants to give Muslims the day off, so they can worship properly. Abdul Jalil bin Khalil agrees.
Most of the time, it takes me an extra hour to get to Friday prayer. I have to get my son from his school to the mosque, and then I have to rush back to the office. So I think the switch is a good idea.
But outside the mosque, some non-Muslims don't like the new Friday-Saturday weekend, especially for students like Praveena.
Because suddenly God changes, I like feel like something... I don't like...
You just don't want to go to school on Sunday.
Yeah.
Johor used to start its weekends on a Friday, but it was changed 2 decades ago because state leaders didn't want Johor to be out of line with international markets, and it has paid off. Johor is thriving, and billions of dollars have been pouring into this area to attract foreign investors. In front of me is a brand new mosque that's going to open, a shopping center, as well as new residential buildings. And that's because just across the straits, I can see Singapore. The tiny city-state is running out of space, so many Singaporeans now set up their factories and offices in the southern tip of Malaysia because it's cheaper. These workers are building a villa more than 2,000 square meters. The price you pay for this place will only buy a tiny flat in Singapore.
So one big pool, they'll have a barbecue area.
Canadian David Boxler designs these luxury homes. Private businesses like his can choose when they want to start their weekend.
So the switch in the weekend's good or bad thing?
Overall, it hasn't affected my business that much. We've changed to a part-time flexi weekend, so employees can opt in if they want to or not. But me as an investor on the other side of the coin, it has made me take a step back and not invest in some land I was planning on purchasing, because we need to have confidence that rules aren't going to suddenly change. So I want to sit back for a bit and just see how things go over the next year.
It's a bigger adjustment for his staff. Linda Hamid has chosen to stick with the regular weekend.
Is it going to affect your family, though?
Yeah, because I have a son who's schooling primary one this year, so he's going to school from Sunday to Thursday instead. So, yeah, it's just going to be like Saturday as a common day weekend for us.
That means you have one last day to spend with your kids.
Yes, that's pretty much it.
So everyone will have to adjust, but it's not clear what the real cost of the weekend switch will be in the long run.
That's the BBC's Jennifer Pack. Up, matchmaker, find me a job.
That's big money, and that's something that's going to
hopefully lead to more fulfilling careers for a lot of people.
But first, let's do the numbers. Financial markets in the U.S. were closed today in observance of Martin Luther King Jr. Day. The markets reopened tomorrow with some 60 companies scheduled to announce earnings this week. European markets were dampened by Deutsche Bank's surprise early release of a loss in the fourth quarter. The German DAX deleted 0.25%. The French CAC 40 fell 0.1%. London's FTSE rose 0.1%. China posted GDP growth of 7.7%, slightly better than expected, not enough for celebration in the Asian markets. In Tokyo, the Nikkei subtracted more than 0.5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. Delta hopes their stock price will keep climbing after they announce earnings. Speaking of airlines, on this day back in 1976, the first Concorde flights took off from London and Paris. And it's National Hug Day. Go ahead. Don't be shy. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. There's no shortage of billionaires in the world of business, of course, but a report released today puts a whole new perspective on wealth and poverty in the world. According to the British humanitarian group Oxfam, the 85 richest people on Earth have the same amount of wealth as the bottom half of the global population. Oxfam says those wealthy individuals make up just a small portion of the richest 1% of the population, and those 1% account for some $110 trillion in wealth, 65 times as much as the bottom half. All right, weak-stomached listeners, we've got a story for you now about rats. Yeah, rats. Well, actually, about rodenticide, the chemicals people use to kill rats. Some of them are poised to come off the shelves, and Jed Kim tells us why.
Susan Frommer has a rat problem. She lives on 10 acres of land midway between L.A. and San Diego. Her home is an oasis in the midst of shrubland, and rats want inside it. She uses snap traps to keep them out of her garage.
I just set it right there. So it's one of the first things they encounter when they come in under the door.
She says during the worst times, the traps will kill multiple rats a day. Susan used to use rodenticides, but then she learned that the toxins were harming other wildlife.
And so we decided to just go cold turkey on the poison and start using the traps.
Many rodenticides act as anticoagulants, killing pests by making them bleed internally. But they're also killing animals that eat rats, coyotes, foxes, birds of prey. And the chemicals are making it to the top of the food chain.
Is that what you put them all in?
Yeah.
Just a few miles away from where Susan deals with her rat problem, Winston Vickers, a veterinarian studying mountain lions, puts a GPS collar on a sedated cougar.
She is online.
The collar will let researchers track the mountain lion's movement. They test each dead lion they find.
We've tested, I believe, 27 animals, and all of them have had anticoagulant rodenticides in their systems.
Scientists worry the compounds may be making predators more prone to disease or maybe hurting reproduction. The most toxic are the second-generation anticoagulants, one of which is Brodificum. It's found in a more familiar name.
Enough's enough. Decon baits are 50% stronger than the competition and can kill in one feeding.
The Decon products are at the center of a long and messy fight between the company that owns Decon, Reckitt Benckiser, and the Environmental Protection Agency. The EPA has been trying to restrict second-generation anticoagulants to professional users. Stephen Bradbury is the director of the Office of Pesticide Programs.
We've concluded that we can essentially eliminate exposure to these second generations in these ecosystems.
All companies but one have complied. Reckitt Benckiser has about a dozen Decon products that would be canceled, and it's been fighting to keep them in homeowners' hands. That fight's been going on for more than 5 years.
It's extremely, extremely rare that a company doesn't voluntarily implement EPA's safety findings.
Reckitt did not respond to requests for comment for this story. Its appeal to the EPA could take years to decide. In the meantime, Decon's still on the shelves. In Los Angeles, I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Numbers show that China's coal production will likely grow about 3% this year. That's despite a government campaign to cut air pollution.
Coal's long history has been intertwined with growth, the industrial age, and lately, pollution and climate change. Barbara Fries is the author of Coal, A Human History. She has this take on coal's image as a brand.
The Chinese were the first to burn coal and also the first to use coal in other ways. They would make brooches or something that anthropologists called ear-piercing ornaments. They appreciated coal for its beauty. Coal really had a very sinister image for centuries. And I don't mean the coal industry, I mean coal itself. It came from these very hellish coal mines. It came from this sort of sinister subterranean world that was dark and spooky and where people frequently died in these horrible fiery explosions. And it was widely assumed that those coal mines were haunted by demons. At the same time, there persisted this belief that the smoke had certain cleansing properties, and the College of Physicians said, burn some coal and maybe add some herbs and things to the smoke, particularly at times of plague. One of the first things ever written about air pollution talked about how suddenly London was resembling a suburb of hell. In fact, Queen Elizabeth was, quote, greatly grieved and annoyed with the taste and smoke of sea coals. But then you saw a funny change in the 1800s. And of course, this was when coal really was fueling an industrial revolution and really changing things. Suddenly, there's this literature about coal emerging from theologians and philosophers and missionaries to China who would write back about the coal deposits there. And they attributed to coal this divine and civilizing force. There's this irony to the fact that when Western missionaries went to China, trying to encourage China to use its coal was something they perceived as part of their mission. Now, of course, China is using way more coal than anybody else. There will be an end of coal, and it will be momentous. The speed at which it happens will depend on a lot of things, including environmental regulations and particularly how seriously we take climate change.
Technology is making all kinds of choices for us these days. You know how Netflix and Pandora use algorithms to tell you which movies and music you might like? Well, how about big data suggesting what jobs you should apply for, or even telling employers who they should hire? Shannon Mullen has more.
Boston College senior Isaiah Ben-Ami is on track to graduate this spring with a major in economics. Next, he wants an MBA. First, he needs a job.
Deloitte business analysts are definitely interested in that. Tyco has a manager of strategic account support. Again, something I'll be interested in.
In his apartment on campus, Ben-Ami scrolls through a list of open jobs and internships on aftercollege.com. The site sends college students and recent grads curated job alerts based on where and what they study.
I think they are capable of getting a sense of who I am as a person and tailoring my search to make sure that the jobs that they are posting are intriguing to me.
Ben-Ami signed up a month ago, and he's already had two interviews. His matchmaker is a bunch of math. After College started in 1999 as a searchable job board, tracking who applied for what. Last year, the company fed all that data through an algorithm and started recommending jobs. CEO Roberto Angulo.
You have basically a reduced likelihood that you're going to end up in a job you don't like, or that you're going to become a worker that the employer doesn't like.
After College is one of a growing number of companies developing high-tech tools for the job market. As the economy recovers, millions of people still need jobs. And Rosemary Hafner with CareerBuilder.com says the hiring process is outdated.
It's pretty insane. You know, you send in a piece of paper, whether it's
through a job board and it's electronic or it's hard copy, you know, and it's, here's my life story. Please, recruiter, read it.
Hafner says the interview process is like going on a few dates, then getting married.
And what these products that are coming into the marketplace are really saying, there's so many more important parts to figure out if it's a match.
A new company called Knack makes video games employers can use to analyze job applicants' personalities and talents. In one game called Wasabi Waiter, you play a server in a busy sushi bar who has to multitask to keep customers happy.
And from that, they can infer all sorts of characteristics about you, like your perseverance and your creativity, even your extroversion. And those are things that don't show up on your resume or your college transcript.
Eric Brynjolfsson is a Knack advisor, and he's head of MIT's Center for Digital Business. He says using big data to connect more companies with the right talent could have trillions of dollars in economic value.
Doing matchmaking for people's careers and for the efficiency of companies and ultimately for the whole economy, that's big money, and that's something that's going to hopefully lead to more fulfilling careers for a lot of people.
Brynjolfsson says technology is also opening up how companies work, the way the microscope changed the study of biology. In the future, more hiring decisions will be based on hard data instead of software and gut reactions. In Boston, I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the show is about football. No, not all the Richard Sherman hubbub. Come on, this is a business show. We are talking about ticket prices for the Super Bowl. If you're a Broncos or Seahawks fan and you want to check out the big game in New Jersey on February 2nd, start saving now. It's going to cost you. The cheapest ticket options right now are, ready for this, $2,500 on StubHub. For $200 more, you can pick up some tickets on the NFL's secondhand marketplace. What do you get for that price? Good old-fashioned nosebleed seats high up at the Meadowlands. I'm going to stay on my couch because it's free. All right, that's it. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. The financial markets in the U.S. will be open tomorrow. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner and Tommy Andres. Millie Jefferson directs the show. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.